reading is from John chapter 12, verses 20 to 33. This is from the Scholar's Version. There were some Greeks among those who had come up to worship at the festival. These people came to Philip, who was from Bethsaida, Galilee, and requested of him, "Sir, we would like to meet Jesus." Philip goes and tells Andrew, and both Andrew and Philip go and tell Jesus. And Jesus responds, "The time has come for the human one to be glorified. Let me tell you this, unless the kernel of wheat falls to the earth and dies, it remains a single seed. But if it dies, it produces a great harvest. If you love your life, you'll lose it. But if you hate your life in this world, you'll preserve it for unending life. Whoever serves me must follow me, for wherever I am, my servant must be there also. Whoever serves me, the Father will honor. Now life is in turmoil, but should I say, 'Father, rescue me from this moment?' No, it was to face this moment that I came. 'Father, glorify your name.' Then a voice spoke out of the sky, 'I have glorified it, and I will glorify it even more.' The crowd there heard this, and some people remarked that it was thunder, others that a heavenly messenger had spoken to him. 'That voice did not come for me, but for you,' Jesus answered. 'Now sentence is passed on this world. Now the ruler of this world will be driven out, and if I am elevated from the earth, I'll take everyone with me.' He said this to show what kind of death he was going to die."
During the season of Lent, I've used the lectionary passages. I often go back and forth on that, but I've used them this season. And the lectionary reading for today is that passage from the Gospel of John. Gospel of John is, scholars generally believe, is one of the latest Gospels of the four we have in the canon, probably nearly 100 years after the birth of Jesus, probably in the 90s. It was written, and so it reflects a theological view in which Jesus is pretty confident, pretty high Christology is the fancy word for that. So he comes down, and he knows everything that's going on. He does his thing and carries his own cross and so forth. But Christianity centers around the martyrdom of Jesus, and I want to talk a little bit about that. And the four gospel accounts that made it into the New Testament all feature extensive accounts of Jesus' execution. There were other gospels of Jesus, notably the Gospel of Thomas, that do not feature Jesus as a martyr. Jesus in the Gospel of Thomas is primarily a wisdom teacher. Scholars of early Christianity like Elaine Pagels and Karen King have shown that martyrdom was not the only possible path for early Christianity. They have a commentary on an interesting book called The Gospel of Judas that opposes particularly this emphasis on martyrdom, and especially the expectation to get oneself killed for God as the path to true Christianity. Early church fathers painted martyrdom in a glorious way, that if you martyred yourself, you would get a glorious resurrection, rewards in heaven. And the Gospel of Judas criticized these leaders who encouraged this type of martyrdom, a little bit excessive. Ignatius, who wrote not maybe even less than 10 years after the Gospel of John, in 108, wrote about being ground up by the teeth of wild beasts to become God's wheat. So that was a pretty heavy call. Tertullian, a century later, famously said that the blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church. Early Christian literature and medieval literature is filled with dramatic stories of derring do, of martyrs and their punishments, and in some cases their zeal to become martyrs, to die violently for their faith and expectation for a reward in heaven. And there is a sense that Christianity did succeed, was popular for many because of the thrill of martyrdom. You know, what a great heroic way to go, right? Killed as a martyr for God. In fact, a popular game still today, if you go to church camp, is persecution, in which the children are taught to follow Jesus by, you know, dying for their faith. The Gospel of John pushes heavily on this glorious martyrdom tradition. In John, Jesus has no doubts whatsoever about how his dying on the cross was a way of elevation to God. He even mocks the notion put forth in the other Gospels about Jesus' agony in Gethsemane. For John, there is no agony. Now my life is in turmoil, but should I say, Father, rescue me from this moment? No, it was to face this moment that I came. Father, glorify your name. Then a voice spoke out of the sky, you know, confirming what he has to say. I have glorified it and will glorify it even more. So in the Gospel of John, there's no Simon of Cyrene who carries the cross partway for Jesus. Jesus can carry his own cross. Thank you very much. The Gospel of John sees Jesus' death as planting a seed. Jesus is a kernel of wheat who, by being martyred, by dying, ultimately produces a great harvest. So the Gospel of John also has Jesus encourage his disciples to do the same thing. Let me tell you this. Unless the kernel of wheat falls to the earth and dies, it remains a single seed. But if it dies, it produces a great harvest. If you love your life, you'll lose it. But if you hate your life in this world, you preserve it for unending life. Whoever serves me must follow me, for wherever I am, my servant must be there also. And whoever serves me, the Father will honor. So you can see the link from this passage to in John's Gospel to Tertullian, who said the blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church. Or Ignatius, being ground up by the teeth of wild beasts, is to become God's wheat. The word that's translated into English as martyr comes from the Greek word martus. And when we hear martyr, we hear someone who's been killed for their faith or from some other cause. But the Greek word martus has more meanings than just that. In the 35 times that it appears in the New Testament, it is translated as witness. A witness is someone from a legal sense who has seen something. It also has a religious sense as to bearing witness, to testify that something is true, to speak your truth, we might say today, to say what you have seen. So martus can be translated as witness or as martyr, depending on the context. So let's look at this for a second. What was Martin Luther King Jr.? Primarily, Martin Luther King Jr. was a witness. He was assassinated, so one could say he was a martyr, but that isn't really what we remember him for. We remember him for his work for civil rights, for his speaking the truth to power, for even in his later years opposing at great opposition, in fact, even alienating those who had been his allies all the way through when he spoke out against the Vietnam War and the crises of poverty and militarism and racism. So he was a martus in that first sense of the word, primarily and chiefly. A bearing witness to truth and justice and love, and only secondarily was he a martyr in that second sense of the word. And he didn't seek to go out and do it. I don't think he thought he was any glory in it. He was shot on a balcony in a motel room in a motel in Memphis, Tennessee. So in a sense, he did die, one might say, for the faith, a martyr, but his real martus, in the Greek sense, was that he bore witness in his life. Imam Hussein, he is the grandson of the Prophet Muhammad, and Hussein Day is this year is going to be April 28th. And I've been honored to be a speaker at a panel honoring Imam Hussein, so I didn't even know really anything about him. And I'm starting to, and history recounts that he was beheaded in a battle and thus became a martyr in that second sense of the word. But first of all, he was a witness, according to those who honor and celebrate the life of Imam Hussein. He spoke out against oppression and injustice in his own time. And in that case, he was a witness. Sheikh Nimr al-Nimr, as a Shia cleric of recent time, was just beheaded. Actually, a few years ago, I met his son, Muhammad al-Nimr. Sheikh Nimr al-Nimr was executed by the Saudi government because they wanted to silence him. Sheikh Nimr spoke out boldly against Saudi human rights abuses. And his witness has, in a sense, become a seed that continues to grow in those who remember not just him, not just his death, but the truth that he tells and stands up for. So the question before us is, to what are you a martus, a witness? Perhaps for those who preserve human rights, to preserve speech, a witness to accept uncomfortable truths, to defend those falsely accused, a witness to imagine a better world. And what I am hearing as our nation has taken a turn toward fear, especially over the past 16 years, is a sense of despair, that nothing really does any good, that the opposition is too great. Why learn about all of these things if there's really nothing I can do about it? Nothing can be done. Hearing the truth or speaking of it is little value because there's nothing I can do to change it. What can I do about it? And the answer from our religious traditions to those questions are, as you can be a martus, the Greek sense of that, which means more than just going out and dying. It means actually bearing witness to what is true and what is good and what is beautiful and what is valuable, even when there is no reward, especially when. Earlier I quoted Tertullian that the blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church. I say it differently, I would say. The truth of those who bear witness is the seed of human flourishing. And this is regardless of one's religion, whether one's Christian or Muslim or Jew or anything else or none of the above. The truth of those who bear witness is the seed of human flourishing. Bear witness to what is beautiful. Bear witness to what is true. Bear witness to what is good. There's a phrase in our Presbyterian Book of Order, a paragraph called Truth and Goodness. And it was put together in probably the 18th century. And so it has kind of that type of language to it. It says, truth is an order to goodness, and the great touchstone of truth is its tendency to promote holiness according to our Savior's rule. By their fruits ye shall know them. And that no opinion can either be more pernicious or more absurd than that which brings truth and falsehood upon a level and represents it as if no consequence what a person's opinions are. On the contrary, we are persuaded that there is an inseparable connection between faith and practice, truth and duty. Otherwise, it would be of no consequence either to discover truth or to embrace it. There's no postmodernism in this passage that says, oh, who knows what truth is? It's all relative. There's something here that says, no, there must be some kind of true thing in the world. I'm not so postmodern anymore that I'm so cynical that spin is the only thing that matters, because that's what we live under now, the spin of the powerful who give us what they think is the truth, tell us it's the truth, so that we simply go along with them. And so it's been courageous people throughout history who have said, no, we will not acquiesce to the spin of the powerful. We will bear witness to the truth as best as we can, knowing that none of us has a claim upon it, but we are all under its light. And the dying that might be done is not, perhaps it can be done, like Martin Luther King, the willingness to be able to put oneself on the line. But most of us probably are not going to face that. I don't know a whole lot of people personally. I think my mother was a martus, but she didn't die for her faith. But she was definitely a witness to what was good and beautiful and lovely and important and hopeful. The dying that really needs to be done is our own ego and our ego's shallow desires. Because even the quest for a glorious martyrdom is really ego-driven. So one needs to die to one's own need to be ego, to be it's about me. So we're invited not only as Christians and as Muslims and as Jews and as Buddhists and as Hindus and as Wiccans and as those who practice no religion at all, except perhaps human fulfillment, to bear witness, to seek to tell the truth as best we can, even when, and I will say especially when, truth is not popular nor strategic. My final statement If we are to be saved, and I believe and I trust that we will be, it will be because of librarians. Librarians are the most courageous people I know, and they have the most important task I know, and that is to preserve culture, to preserve the writings that have come down to us, to resist attempts at not only censorship, but book burning or book banning or control of what might be said and what might not be. And so listen to those courageous stories of librarians who stand up simply for books and for writings and for access so that everyone might be able to know what was said at one time. In an Orwellian time in which history is being rewritten by the powerful, it is essentially important, I believe, for librarians and for those of us to bear witness to what is good and true. And I guess I do have one more final thing. Because a sermon sounds like it's like a heavy duty, go out and do all this stuff. No, actually, it feels good. It's actually good. There's an incredible lifting of darkness, I think, when people are able to die to one's own ego and live for what is true and beautiful and peaceful. The stories of those who have done that in history are really spiritual stories. And it does feel like life matters again. Did you know that we are some of the most depressed people, Americans? And one of the reasons for that is because of the ego thing. There was a study done that asked for people who wanted to become happy, and they asked and they make a commitment to become happy. And all over the world, people who made a commitment to become happy became happier, except for Americans. They didn't become happier. Because according to this study, when people of other cultures, which are more communal, perhaps, than ours, happiness is a result of doing something for somebody else. Whereas Americans thought that happiness means going out to your favorite restaurant, or treating yourself, or somehow doing something for yourself in that way. And that does not necessarily lead to happiness, as they found out. It actually makes you more depressed. But the ones of those who sought happiness by seeking to do good for others actually attain a level of happiness. And I think that is a truth that transcends all of our religious truths, but also brings all of those religious truths to a beautiful and higher light, ultimately leading with peace within. Now, I guess I have one more thing. And that's that seed thing. Back to the answer of, or the question of, gosh, if I know, but it's so overwhelming. No, the seed is planting a seed. It's when teachers know this, right? You are planting seeds with your students. And you never know what the result might be. And you can't even dictate how that growth is going to come. But the idea of planting seeds is a powerful, beautiful metaphor, I think, for a Christian life or a Muslim life or a Jewish life or a life of integrity. To be able to say, I don't know how I'm going to be able to solve the world's problems, but I'm going to plant my little seed right here, and we'll see what happens. Amen.